Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
has now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Well, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Mr. Dave Martino is taking a break from baseball.
We're back to the baseball thing.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, it's either that or knife fighting, whatever.
Yeah.
You know. You get banned from that yet?
Not from TikTok, no.
No?
Just once.
Well, I mean,
instead of just doing dangerous acts.
Yeah, well, I'm going to report you to Facebook, just so you know.
I'm going to
do that right now. Get you taken down.
Such a troublemaker, Al.
I am a troublemaker. Now, speaking of troublemakers, the guy on his first episode as co-host, Al, from guest, we've got Mr. Joe CIA Goldberg.
I'm here.
See,
I dressed up nice for you, sucky been a podcast.
You dressed up nice. But, yeah, you know, he's not got any cameras going on, so, you know.
What's this world coming to?
I know. Yeah. Things are falling apart.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to doing this.
Yeah.
Good conversations.
Yeah, you are in this business, so you know it. Sort of.
Yeah, sort of.
Sort of. Shh. Okay, so now we've got a special guest today. So we'll just bring him in. So, Mr. Brian Freeman, thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely. If we're talking about dangerous acts, hey, I'm there.
Well, you shouldn't talk about your wife. Come on. Oh, boy. What a way to start a show.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. So you got the new book, Born Sacrifice. And the first thing I can say is what brought you or led you into doing books that have already sort of been out, like, you know what I mean? Like this Born has been around. So what made you go this direction?
Yeah, it was sort of an interesting change of pace because I had, at that point, about 20 books out under my own name and really very different kinds of books than you find in the Jason Bourne series. I mean, the Bourne books are very action-oriented, very adrenaline-focused, and my books, my own novels, tend to be more psychological thrillers, sort of thrillers with an emotional core to them. But I found out that Putnam was going out looking for a new thriller writer to take over the Bourne franchise. This was probably about three and a half years ago. And my agent asked if I was interested in tossing my hat into the ring. And, I've been a Ludlum fan my whole life. The Bourne Identity was one of my earliest faves as a thriller writer, as a thriller reader, I could imagine. This was back in 1980. I think it was all of 17 years old that I first read The Bourne Identity. And so I said, yeah, let's go after it. And honestly, I was a little surprised when they picked me, only because my own books are very, very different. But I think that Jason Bourne as a hero actually fits with the kinds of stories and that I tell and the characters I create, because he's a very complex psychological hero. He's not sort of this Jack Reacher style superhero. I mean, he's fractured, he's lost his memory, and he's struggling with sort of this existential crisis of who he really is as a man. And so for me, that kind of was right in my wheelhouse. But it was intimidating thinking about sort of stepping into the shoes of a giant like Ludlum and this sort of iconic hero like Bourne, particularly when, you know, dealing with characters that I hadn't actually created. But then I thought about it and thought, well, actually, I've known Jason Bourne a lot longer than I've actually known any of my own characters. I'd known Bourne for more than 40 years. So kind of once I got over that hill, it felt kind of natural to sort of step into Bourne's world and, you know, bring him into a whole new environment. So I was trying to be very authentic to Ludlum's character, but to drop him down into, you know, a modern setting, all new plots, all new characters, kind of like a reboot of the entire series.
Well, is there a born Bible that, so to speak, that you have to follow? You know, and how much freedom do you have to take this character into these new directions?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and that was really one of the questions I had in talking with the Putnam folks about this. I mean, how much freedom would I have to kind of strike out in new directions? And I give them a lot of credit and the estate a lot of credit that they have really given me a free hand to sort of, you know, put my own stamp on Jason Bourne. I know when I turned in my first Bourne book, The Bourne Evolution, one of the things I felt best about was that Putnam ran the manuscript by the estate, and they came back a few weeks later and said, you know, we don't want to change a word. We love it exactly as it is. So that made me feel really good. And they've been very supportive with my decisions along the way. Because honestly, that was probably the hardest part for me is the first book, The Bourne Evolution, kind of felt like an homage to Ludlum and the Bourne identity. And then when I was starting the second novel, which was The Bourne Treachery, it was harder for me. It felt like a harder book to write. And I realized that I kind of needed to give myself permission to make Bourne my own character and to really let him begin to change and evolve based on the things that were happening to him in my books. And so once I did that, and once I sort of realized that, well, at this point, Ludlum and I sort of share ownership of this character, then things sort of flowed more readily, because I realized I could actually, you know, take Bourne and move him in new directions based on everything that was happening in my books.
Right. The question I have is, a lot of your books, you have really good place, time, space. How did you feel doing that, immersing yourselves in a Ludlum world of place times, kind of attracting the senses of the readers and bringing them into your books?
Yeah, that's a good question, because you know, Ludlum really had such an, you know, international focus, really in all of his books, but certainly in the Bourne books in particular. And I've always felt that the sense of place really enriches the drama of a thriller. So I'm always focused, whether it's my books or the Bourne books, on giving readers sort of a you are there feel, like you've been dropped down into every scene and you can hear it and touch it and taste it and smell it and feel it happening all around you. And, you know, usually what I try to do is you know, take all of the scenes and put them in places that I know pretty well. And I go out and scout locations for the books, sort of the way a film director would. But that's been a little trickier with my recent books and with the Bourne books, partly with Bourne, because it sort of involves going all over the world. And more specifically, because for the last, you know, two or three years, nobody's been going anywhere. So I had to simply do a lot more site research and try to familiarize myself with locations, you know, with research, as opposed to being able to actually go out and be there myself. You know, it's not my preferred way of doing it, but I think it's actually worked pretty well. And in most cases, what I do is look for locations that at least I have visited in the past. So I already have kind of a sense of what that place feels like. And then I can sort of fill in the gaps around that.
So you really kind of write your location like you would write a character.
Yeah, very much so. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that the setting has to be as much of a character in the book as the people, because that really immerses the reader in what's going on. It's got to be more than just the story. I mean, the setting ought to be ramping up the drama of what's happening.
How do you deal with the pressure? But like when you take over someone else's established, you know, success, so to speak, didn't you feel a great deal of pressure to kind of come into it and worry about the fans accepting you, so to speak? Because people can be real mean these days, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my first reaction when my agent called and said Putnam wanted me for Bourne, I mean, it was like, oh my God, yeah, that's great. And I think my next reaction was, oh my God. Because, it's definitely intimidating. And you know, you've got a really high standard to live up to, and so many people know Jason Bourne so well in their minds that they have a particular image of who this character is. And what complicates it is that there have been so many iterations of Bourne over the years. It's not like you're simply trying to go back to, you know, one character and one book series. Ludlum had three Jason Bourne novels. Eric von Lustbader took over and did either 10 or 11 Bourne novels. You had all of the great Matt Damon movies, and I may be one of the few people who actually remember that before Matt Damon was Jason Bourne, Richard Chamberlain was actually
yes,
Jason
he was
Bourne. Yes, in a mini series with Jacqueline Smith of Charlie's Angels fame as Marie St. Jacques. So you put it all together, and people are coming into this series and this character with very, very different ideas of who that character is and what the character looks like and what, you know, kind of a person he is. I think if you try to simply, you know, create a mélange that keeps all those people happy, I don't know that it really works. So you kind of have to make your choice. And my personal choice was to go back to the character that Ludlum created in The Bourne Identity and really try to make that character feel new and real and authentic, so that when you read my Bourne books, it should feel like you're going back to Ludlum's original creation, and that's what I've been trying to do in my books. And you know, and then I think a lot of people, they feel that, hey, if they want to, you know, imagine that, you know, that this character looks like, you know, Matt Damon, and they can imagine him, going through all these scenes. Well, that's fine too. I don't have a problem with that. Although the interesting thing is, I think if you watch the Matt Damon movies, you get a very different concept of Bourne as a character. I mean, Bourne in the movies is this sort of, laconic, cynical loner, and it's more focused on the physicality of who he is as opposed to the psychological complexity. And that was a dimension I wanted to bring back, was that psychological depth that Ludlum brought to the original novel.
Well, that's an interesting, let me go back then to your original writing, the series, you know, the Bolton series and the Stride series and the others. I mean, you had to create those characters out of whole cloth. You made those. What was your process in making all these different characters? What did you want to bring into them that you were trying to tell the reader that, hey, this person has this kind of characteristic and personality and response, and then you had to jump into Jason Bourne. What's your idea of creating these characters?
Yeah, that every character, they need to be able to kind of stand on their own two feet, and the only reason, you know, I've done several series. I've done my Stride series. I've got 10 books in the Stride series. The 11th is coming out, The Zero Night, on November 1st. I've got a couple Cab Bolton novels. I've got three Frost Easton novels, and then, you know, probably half a dozen standalones at this point as well. All of them then with very, very different heroes. My philosophy has always been there's no point in creating a new series unless you're going to bring a very different hero to the fore. I mean, if Cab Bolton is going to be the same as Jonathan Stride, or if Frost Easton is going to be the same as Cab Bolton, well then, heck, you know, let me just write my original series and stay with that. For me, the fun really is in really creating very distinctive, unique characters for each book that I'm working on, whether it's, you know, a long lasting character that may be in the series, or you know, a hero that's only going to appear in one novel in a standalone. But what I'm always looking to do is not get between that character and the reader. I mean, I try to write and edit in such a way that the character is speaking directly to the reader, and I'm not kind of, you know, being a go-between. I want the connection between the reader and the character to be very direct. I try to pull myself out of it. And when it comes to someone like Bourne, what I needed to do was really sort of examine what the dimensions were that make Bourne unique, and why he's been such an enduring figure in thriller literature. And I think what I took away from it was the fact that it's that whole question of identity that drives Bourne as an attractive character. I mean, I think that's what people relate to, because here clearly Bourne is taking this all to a very, you know, dramatic extreme, given the nature of who he is and what he does. And yet at the same time, he's wrestling with some pretty fundamental questions about what his morality is and what his ethics are. And I think that everybody has to deal with those same kinds of things. And so I think having having Bourne go down that journey, it's a journey that we're all following, and that's what I was trying to play up in my take on Bourne.
Well, speaking of your characters, how do you experience them? Are you one of these writers who has an inner monologue? Can you hear the character in your head? Is that how you create dialogue, or do you have some other method?
Yeah, you know, I don't really hear the characters in my head, but I will say that they kind of take over the process. I don't tend to question it a lot, because I always feel like if you start to question too much where the inspiration's coming from, well, maybe you'll wake up one day and it won't be there anymore. Mm. So for me, I used to outline in a lot of detail. I used to write very exhaustive background sketches on all the characters, and the more books I've written, the more I have gone away from that, because I was finding that it didn't matter how much preparation I did before I started, the characters and the story would have a way of coming to life and taking over as I actually got the words on paper. And so I really wanted to give them their freedom to run and find that they would come to life better if I wasn't trying to prejudge who they were. And certainly the last thing I wanted to do was try to impose my vision of who those characters should be on the characters themselves, because whenever I would try to do that, I would feel them kind of pushing back on me, and ultimately I realized, well, you know, they kind of know themselves better than I do, and so the way it works best is when I can kind of let them be guiding me as opposed to me guiding them, and you know, in any given chapter, it tends to be sluggish as long as I'm, you know, sort of in charge of the process. And when it works is when, you know, I can kind of feel myself separating out from the characters in the action, and they're sort of the ones that are you know, putting these thoughts together, and I'm just sort of typing at that point.
So I'll give you permission to use me as the next, you know, instead of Matt Damon, you can use me.
Don't do it, Brian. Don't do it.
I'm looking at my screen. I'm thinking, well, here, Joe's the only one that doesn't have a photograph on that screen.
Well, yeah, because he's dangerous. Yeah. Well, you know, but how do you keep it fresh, in a sense, when there's been a lot of stories written with these characters and things like that? So how does you go into it kind of trying to keep it fresh?
Yeah. I was talking with Tom Colgan at Putnam about that exact question, and my feeling is, when it comes to series books, is that generally speaking, series they don't die because of the plots; they die because of the characters. If all you do is take sort of a static hero and drop him down into a new book with a new plot around him, me personally, I think readers are going to get tired of that pretty fast. I think what keeps a series fresh is that the characters continue to grow and change and surprise you based on what's going on in the books. And so usually when I'm thinking about a series book, whether it's Bourne or whether it's my Jonathan Stride novels or anything else, my first thought is not so much about the plot. My first thought is, where is this character? What's been going on in their lives? What are the things that they're dealing with that they haven't resolved? And then I start to think about how we build a story that will bring those issues out and kind of put them at the foreground. So for example, my new Stride novel, The Zero Night, coming out November 1st, as I was thinking about how that next, you know, series book was going to take shape, and here, you know, this is the 11th novel in the Stride series, I was thinking about Stride's wife, Serena, who's an alcoholic and came out of a very abusive childhood, had a terrible relationship with her mother and hasn't spoken to her mother in years. I was thinking about Serena and feeling that whenever her mother passed away, that was really going to throw Serena for a loop and probably put her in a situation where her sobriety became at risk. And so that was how The Zero Night began to take shape, is I thought this was an issue this character was going to have to deal with. And so I built a mystery around something that would bring that whole essence and thread of the character to the forefront of the story.
So where do you see yourself going with this series? Or do you have this kind of planned out in your mind somewhat? Do you have it kind of outlined, kind of what you want to do with this character?
You know, I don't really. I don't like to get too far ahead of the books because, again, I think that what keeps a series fresh is when the character evolves based on what's happening to them in the stories. And so you can't really get too far ahead of yourself because ultimately the character is going to evolve with each of the novels that gets released. I also think that particularly when it comes to an action series like Bourne, you always need to be looking for ways to kind of reboot and keep it fresh. I've written three Bourne novels now, and I'm literally in the home stretch of the fourth Bourne book, The Bourne Defiance. And in a lot of ways, The Bourne Defiance is kind of a denouement for a lot of the threads that I built up in the first three books. And so I kind of see this story arc, kind of coming to a climax in The Bourne Defiance. And I don't know yet what I would plan to do in the fifth Bourne novel, but my expectation would be that I would probably plan another kind of reset and kind of introduce some new characters, introduce some new threads that give us a chance to once again sort of freshen up Bourne. Because again, the longer the series goes, the harder it is for readers to keep up if you're expecting them to have read all of the preceding series books. And B, you want to be able to start throwing curveballs at the hero and give them, new challenges and new directions that are going to, kind of change what's going on in their lives. So I would expect that, with something like Bourne, that every few books I'm going to want to kind of, go back to ground zero and sort of, rebuild the series.
Well, Ludlum was known for his writing trade craft. And I'm just wondering, did you have to do a lot of research, especially to update it for a modern time?
Yeah, that's kind of a good balancing act. I remember I read an interview with Ludlum years and years ago, and he was asked about research, and I thought his reply was great. He said that he does less research than his readers think and more than his family believes. I'm trying to strike that delicate balance. I want the tradecraft and the other elements of the book, whether it's settings or procedures or anything else going on. I want that to feel, authentic, but I also don't want it to slow down the story or weigh down the narrative. I mean, I think that one of the challenges you sometimes find with thriller writers these days is they fall in love a little bit with their equipment and with their research and so they end up kind of they're so into this that they spend a lot of time on details that aren't necessarily really advancing the action of the story. Even great thriller writers can occasionally be guilty of this. I mean, I remember when Tom Clancy was writing the Sum of All Fears and has a nuclear bomb go off. And I think he spent four pages describing the physics of the nuclear explosion in detail. And I was like, oh my God, Tom, it blew up. So that's kind of that balance you want to strike is you want enough detail to sort of satisfy the curiosity, the intrigue of the readers and to make the whole thing feel real and authentic. But you also want to make sure that you're not kind of falling in love with your research so much that you sort of slow down the pace.
Brian, let me ask you a question. You have a lot of books you've written. You said you got the series here, and you have the Bourne series, and you got the ones you have on the, ready to go on the treadmill. Why do you write?
Well, I did a interview a few weeks ago with a group of blind writers. It was actually a Zoom interview, which I thought was rather curious. They said, well, you don't need to worry about makeup or anything. I said, okay, well, that's good. But they asked me a similar question. They said, when did you begin to think of yourself as a writer? And my honest answer was I've never thought of myself as anything else. I'm just one of those people that, writing has been my passion as far back as I can remember. I mean, I can remember starting my first mystery novel all the way back in sixth grade. And I finished my first thriller when I was, I think, either 12 or 13. So that's just always been who I am. So why do I write? I'm not sure I can tell you. It's just kind of the way I'm wired. I've just always seen the world through the lens of stories and characters. If you read my book, Thief River Falls, which is a standalone thriller set up in far northwestern Minnesota, the hero of Thief River Falls is a thriller writer like me by the name of Lisa Power. And Lisa is trying to protect this young child who shows up outside her farmhouse. And they're driving around the empty roads out there near Thief River Falls. And the boy is asking her, well, what does it mean to be a thriller writer? To be and how do you see the world? And so she pulls off the road and asks him what he sees around him. And he talks about, you know, seeing the cornfields and the dirt road and the farmhouses. And she says, well, you know, I see all of that. But I see a lot of other things as well. I see this body out in the field, and I see this police car coming down the road and kicking up dust. And I know who this victim is, and I know who this man is behind the wheel and what's going on in his life. And that's just the overlay with which I see the world. And for me, that's always been true for me as well. I mean, I can remember being 7, 8 years old in Michigan, where my parents had a cottage, and I'd go out, you know, walking in the evenings with my dad, and you know, we'd be going around these old rural areas, and I'd be wondering what's going on behind the, you know, the door of that barn, and I'd be wondering what's happening, you know, where the cornfield is rustling, and so I've never just seen what's there. I've always been thinking about what's behind it, and I think that's just what writers do.
But you might just be someone that's always written, but where does the confidence come from, do you think? Because there's a lot of people that write and at different stages and for different reasons, but where do you gain the confidence to actually let everybody read it, put it out there?
Well, when it arrives, I'll let you know. You know, that's one of the funny things. I think that being a writer is just an inherently neurotic profession, and I assume there are writers out there that have, you know, egos that let them, you know, assume that they are masters of the universe. But boy, I don't meet a lot of them. They're all sort of, you know, a little bit broken in that regard, like me. And I talk to aspiring writers, and I say, look, you are always going to be your own worst enemy. And the challenge that most aspiring writers face is not from, you know, readers or editors or publishers or booksellers or anybody else. It's from inside their own head, and that voice that keeps telling you, well, no, I can't do this. And I said, you know, you have to learn to live with that voice and use that voice to kind of inspire you. Because I'll tell you, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're working on your first novel or your 26th novel, which is what I'm doing right now, that sense of doubt and uncertainty and fear and that sense that, well, maybe this time around all that inspiration is going to be gone, I don't think that ever leaves you. So, I mean, and I'm not sure that if I had the confidence of feeling like, well, hell, I can do this, no problem. I think if that was the attitude I brought in, I think the books would suffer, because I think it's partly that neurosis and that crisis of confidence that makes you work harder and you know, makes you invest so much of your soul in the story and the characters. I think it just makes for better books.
Well, having written, I believe you just said 27 books, have you found any motifs, any recurring themes in your work? And if so, do you feel that this is deliberate or it's just been unconscious?
Yeah, you know, I for my own books, and that's a little different from, you know, what I'm doing with Born, but for my own books, I've really honed in on writing thrillers that have a really emotional core. And I try to tell stories that are going to engage the reader, and if you know, if I can have the reader in tears at the end of the book, I think that's great. And that may seem like sort of an odd philosophy for a mystery or thriller writer, but I really want the reader so connected to the characters that they are in touch with their suffering, whether it's the heroes or whether it's some of the characters that do some of the worst things in the books, because they understand by the end of the book what it was about their past that drew them across some dark lines. So I look, for example, at my novel, The Deep, Deep Snow, which was an Edgar Award finalist a couple of years ago. It's one of my all-time favorites among anything that I've done. And one of the reasons for that is that I wrote The Deep, Deep Snow sort of as a specific challenge to myself in writing a mystery, that it really is not a book that has anything to do with violence or depravity or evil. It really is populated only by good people, and unfortunately good people that make some terrible mistakes in the way that ordinary good people do, and the ripple effects of those mistakes create this dark tragedy. But it's a book that that makes you realize that what it is really like to be human, and to have to sort of confront your mistakes, and how those mistakes can either turn you into a better person or take you down a terrible road.
That's interesting. You brought up another question in my head then, is you mentioned you're a thriller mystery writer. Have you ever thought of leaving the genre? Do you have inside you the next great American novel that you want to get out there that's not a thriller mystery novel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love telling different kinds of stories, and for me, that's a big part of the fun. I mean, in a lot of ways, what I've really enjoyed about the Bourne series is it's so different from the kinds of stories that I tell under my own name. A few years ago, I actually wrote a very different kind of book, a couple different kinds of books that were practically, chick lit. I mean, they were really more romances. There was a book called The Agency that was published under a pseudonym, Allie O'Brien. That was a project I actually worked on with my agent in London. And then I wrote a follow-up novel called West 57, under the name B.N. Freeman. Very, very different kinds of books. Really nothing, mystery or thriller about them. More just sort of, contemporary fiction. And I loved writing those books. They were a lot of fun to write. I can see, as I'm getting older and doing more books, I would love to have a chance to go in some different directions. I mean, I can see myself doing historical fiction. I could even see myself, finding a nonfiction project to work on. I mean, I frankly would love to, find someone that I could, team up with on an autobiography or memoir or something like that, to be able to tell somebody else's story. For me, I don't put any kind of limits on where I might choose to go. I mean, I love the mystery and thriller genre, and I'm sure I'll always be writing in that genre, but I can certainly see myself branching off in other directions as well.
What do you tell a young writer or someone that's just starting out? And frankly, this is just for me, because, I want to be a writer like you. I want to be like bestseller and all that stuff. So what is it I need to do?
Well, the first piece of advice I always give aspiring writers is pretty simple, that 100% of unwritten books have never been published. It sounds simple, but boy, an awful lot of aspiring writers forget that, because they get caught up in, well, I want to do this, or maybe I want to do that, or maybe I want to do this. And they write 50 pages in something and then get discouraged with themselves and put it aside and switch to something else. I always tell folks, look, take an idea, see it all the way through to the end. Don't give up on your idea and keep switching over to something else. Put the finishing touch, get to the end of a project, and you'll be amazed at the depth of satisfaction that goes along with that. It doesn't mean that first book has to be fantastic, or that one is necessarily going to be the one that's your breakthrough book. I mean, I wrote 5 books in my life that are still sitting in my nightstand drawer. And that goes back to when I was 13 and, not a whole lot of publishers clamoring for books written in Bic pen on binder paper. But that experience taught me how to write, taught me the kinds of characters and stories that I wanted to tell. And it helped me kind of cut my teeth so that when ultimately I started in on Immoral, which was my first Jonathan Stride novel, I was ready to break through. My life experience and craft experience had come to bear at a point where I'd kind of crossed the threshold that I needed to cross. And so that, I think that's a big part of it for aspiring writers is really beginning to, you know, take your craft seriously and see it all the way through and begin to understand how other writers do what they do and how you do what you want to do. I think it may have been James Michener who said that you shouldn't even try to get published until you've written about 1,000,000 words. So I figured with those 5 books in my nightstand, I had to be getting pretty darn close.
Yeah, you know, but when you write those early books, when you're starting and you're writing these books and they're still in your nightstand, each time you complete one of those books, there's something you kind of get out of it and you become a better writer. As I see it. So yeah. now that you're a little older and you've actually
I'm written, a lot older, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to be nice here. Come on. But you know, at the end of the day here, you when you write a book today, what do you think you get out of it?
Yeah, I get a lot of emotional satisfaction out of the book. I don't know who it was that said, I don't necessarily love writing, but I love having written. You know, I would have to fall into that camp. I mean, I enjoy the writing process and I enjoy the battle of getting the story told and having the characters unfold, but it is a battle. I mean, it is a very, very tough emotional kind of job. And there are a lot of days where there's just about anything I'd rather do than stare at that blank screen and have to sort of dig down into some really dark places in order to pull out, you know, effective thrillers. And yet then I get to the end of the book and I edit the novel and I can see all the words on the paper and the characters are alive on the page. That is just such a, That's such an irreplaceable sensation that it you really feel like you have, you know, delivered something unto the world. One of the things I found that I never really anticipated would be something that I'd enjoy, but I look forward to listening to the audio versions of my own books. And for a lot of time, I could not do that because I would hear the books in my head in a certain way. And I felt like listening to somebody else read my words just wouldn't work for me. And then I listened to January Lavoie, the actress who does The Deep, Deep Snow. It was such a moving experience for me because she sort of turned it into a whole new book, and it was almost as if I wasn't listening to my own words, and yet I knew they were my words. And I got to the end of the book, and I've got you know listening to her tell it, and I've got tears running down my face, and I said to my wife, I mean that's why I became a writer, is to be able to put these experiences in the hands of readers.
So what's the day in the life of Brian? And I mean that as a writer, or anything else you want to throw in there too, right? We'd always like to hear, but, and I mean, cause you're saying how some days you're sitting, right? And looking and at the paper and stuff like that. So do you actually schedule like 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and sit and write, or do you have to, be in a certain mood, or what goes on in your life?
Yeah, I was in the traditional workforce for so long that I still see writing as, well, that's my job. And, you know, you do your job 9 to 5. And so, yeah, I typically work, you know, Monday through Friday and, you know, I get up in the morning and have coffee and read the paper. And then I you know, shut myself in my office. I do try to sort of switch up my routines. I don't like to, kind of do the same process, you know, book after book, because I think the process is part of what keeps you inspired, and I don't ever want it to feel stale. So I switch up a lot of the mechanics of how I do things. Sometimes I write sitting down, sometimes I write standing up, sometimes I write in my office, sometimes I take my laptop out of the deck and work outside. So I'm always kind of shifting things around so that I don't get too comfortable in my surroundings. I always like to have a little bit of that edge, because I think that's what keeps me focused.
Is there a part of the writing and editing process that you dread?
Yeah. There's a heck of a question.
That I dread? No. You know, I certainly know that the part that I like the most is the editing side of it, because, you know, then I'm done, you know, I mean, all the words are on the page, and I get to, you know, fuss over it and, you know, tweak it and polish it and get it just perfect. I love that part of it, because the really laborious, emotional, difficult work is behind me at that point.
Right.
I think the challenge is usually, at the very beginning, because when when you're designing the plot for a whole new book, particularly if it's a standalone, I mean, a series book, at least you've got the characters as kind of bedrock to get you started. But a standalone novel where you're starting everything from scratch, I sort of think of it kind of like standing in the toothpaste aisle at Target. And, you know, I mean, instead of having, you know, two or three, you know, varieties of toothpaste, well, you're sitting there staring at what, you know, 125 different types of toothpaste. And you're like, well, with that much to choose from, how on earth do I pick one? And I think that can be a little bit of how you feel about plotting out a standalone, because when you can go in all of these different directions, how do you narrow in on the particular story that you want to tell and the particular characters that you want to bring to life? And it there's so much possibility out there that it can kind of leave you a little bit paralyzed, and you need to be able to sort of get past that and start to focus in on this story feels right.
Brian, let me go back just a second to your discussion about Audible. I totally agree with you. When you hear your words for the first time, it is something. But don't you have Scott Brick doing your doing the latest Bourne?
Yeah, Scott does all of them. Yeah, so, he also did Ludlum's Bourne novels as well.
Yes. So there's no problem with that. You got Scott doing. In fact, when I used to start writing, I turned on some of his stuff and I go, okay, Scott, talk to me. I want to hear that. I want to hear it so I can hear my book. He's just that good.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. But go back, the comment you just gave on the editing process, that's a tough process. And sometimes you write stuff, you go, boy, I love that. I love this scene. I love this thing. And I'm not going to cut it no matter what. And then you realize it doesn't work. What is that feel? What is your editing mindset when you have written all these words and you say, I'm going to have to lose these words to keep my story going?
Yeah. You have to be pretty darn ruthless. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier, that I never want to get between the readers and the story, or between the readers and the character. And, we've got some amazing prose stylists in the mystery and thriller genre, beautiful, beautiful writers. But, you know, sometimes I will read their work, and it's kind of like I can feel them sitting next to me, sort of nudging me and poking me in the side and going, "Boy, that was a really good paragraph, wasn't it?" I never want to be in the middle like that between the reader and the story. And so in the editorial process, I am analyzing everything that I've got, whether it's a paragraph or a chapter, and I'm having to ask myself, is this advancing the story? Is it advancing, you know, the reader's understanding of the characters? And if it's not, then you got to lose it. If it's not playing a fundamental role in advancing the story, then it ends up being self-indulgent. And it may be great writing, but that, you know, the readers are looking to keep turning the pages. And if you're slowing them down or you're getting in the way, then you need to be able to make the hard decision to say, well, okay, it may be beautiful writing, but you know what, if it's not accomplishing what I need to in this book, then it's got to go.
It probably goes into the, maybe I'll use this in a future book file.
Sure, exactly. Yeah, you never know.
Well, and besides me, who would you like to write with?
Yeah. Hey, yeah. How about me?
There's a number of people that it would be fun to write with, although I tend to just think of writing as a pretty solitary profession. So, and I'm not sure how, how good I would be to work with as a co-writer, because I mean I'm always right, you know. So
boss, right?
So then of course I finish a book and I hand it off to my wife and she reads it and I discover, well, I'm not always right. So
your version and the wife's version. Yeah. So now, if someone had never heard of you, hard to believe, what one book would you have them pick up to read, to pick up who you are as a writer?
Yeah, great question. It honestly would be two books that actually, they're technically both standalones, and yet they also fit together hand in glove to the point that I see them really as one book and one creative project. And that would be The Deep, Deep Snow and the follow-up novel to The Deep, Deep Snow, which is called The Ursulina. Those two books are, to me, at this point in my career, kind of the pinnacle of what I'm trying to do with emotional thrillers. I love those two books. I wouldn't change a word of them. And they've really connected with readers on a pretty deep level. I love the kinds of feedback I've gotten from readers about these books. I love listening to January Lavoie do the Audible versions of them. So I would say if you want to get to know who Brian Freeman is as a writer and a person, read The Deep, Deep Snow and then roll right on and read The Ursulina.
So that kind of begs another question of what they should read of yours. Who do you read or who did you read to learn about your craft?
Yeah. You know, I've read a lot of folks over the years and I've read some great, great writers. I don't honestly read a whole lot in the genre myself anymore.
Yes.
Mostly because, you know, when you write suspense all day long, curling up with somebody else's suspense novel at the end of the day, well, it kind of starts to feel like work. You know, it's not really entertainment or escapism in the same way. I mean, I read it more like market research, like, oh, I like that. Yeah, I would have done that differently. Oh, I see where he's going with that. So I tend to read more nonfiction and history and biographies, and I'm pretty eclectic about that. I mean, I'm currently reading Candace Millard's book about the search for the source of the Nile, and before that I was reading a biography about Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. So it kind of goes from the sublime to the ridiculous. But I learn a lot about people in reading nonfiction, and I think those lessons help me in crafting my fiction as well. And then I listen to audiobooks when I'm on the treadmill. And if I'm not listening to mine, and I actually have between Bourne and my new thriller, I Remember You and Stride coming out soon, I've got a lot of my own books to listen to, which is kind of fun. But I like to sample great authors, both modern and historical authors, just to get a sense of how they do what they do. And I'm always, you know, sort of listening to them, thinking about how they're approaching their craft. And I've had a chance to discover some great authors across, you know, the genres. I was listening to Frederick Bachman's A Man Called Uwe earlier in the year, which was, you know, just remarkable. And J.K. Simmons did such an extraordinary job at the narration. V.E. Schwab's The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. I mean, just an extraordinary sort of historical novel. And I went back and explored three of John le Carré's novels to sort of get some Cold War spy thrills. And so that's kind of what I do on the audiobook side. That's where I read more of my fiction, is to sort of listen to how just really great authors do what they do, not necessarily in my genre.
Well, thank you. Same thing. Yeah.
Well,
tell me how you like my book.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, Joe. Well, listen, do you like to interact with people on social media, fans, listeners, and all that? Where can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. I love hearing from readers, whether it's when they're writing me emails or you know, posting on my page. They can find my website at bfreemanbooks.com. That's all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. And then they can shoot me emails through the website. They can find me on social media. I'm out on Facebook at B Freeman Books. I'm out on Twitter and Instagram at B Freeman Books. I love hearing from readers. It's always a lot of fun, particularly when a new book comes out. When you've been sitting there for months, kind of writing yourself out on a limb and waiting for responses, it's great to have a new book come out and start having people write to you and post you and let you know what they think.
Well, of course, we'll have that up on our website. People can find you with one click and send them a nice email. How was COVID for you for the writing part?
Well, it actually, I hate to say it, actually, it was, it kind of worked kind of well for the writing side of it. Cause you end up having to do so many, you know, bookstore events and library events that they're fun to do. I mean, I love having a chance to see readers face to face, but it also, you know, takes you away from your craft for long stretches of time. So, I've written a lot of books in the last 2.5 years. I think I've written 6+ novels in the last 2.5 years. So it's been a very, very intense creative period. And I don't know if that would have been possible if I were, you know, having to, you know, go out and you know, do events. At the same time, I think this year I'm only on track to do probably two novels this year, so I feel like I'm slacking off a bit. But I've been able to get out and see people again, and it is awfully nice to be doing face-to-face events again and hearing from readers and sort of feeding off the energy of crowds, because it's just not the same when you're talking with people via Zoom.
Yeah. Is there any one book you would go back and change, or you wished you could go back and change?
Well, you know, I being a fanatical editor, I think pretty much any book that I've written, if you handed me the print edition, I'd pick it up and start reading and take a red pen and start tweaking it. I'm not sure you're ever really done with a book. You just really kind of reach a point where you have to stop. But that's fine because you reach a point where you have to sort of cut it off and say, you know what, it's ready to go to the readers, and the extra effort you're going to put in is not really going to improve the quality of the book. You're just sort of, you know, rearranging the deck chairs at that point.
Wow. Well, it's been a real pleasure speaking to Mr. Bourne, Mr. Brian Freeman. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.